First, many Muslim Americans experience racism and Islamophobia, especially in the post-9/11 United States. It can be tough to grapple with a sense of identity and belonging in a country that isn't always welcoming. Our next guest shares his story of the challenges and absurdities, the positive moments and the funny moments, too. Wajahat Ali was born and grew up in California, the child of Pakistani-American immigrant parents. He tries to use humor to cope with discrimination and to tell the story of his experience finding himself in the United States. And he says alongside the challenges, he feels a lot of hope. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or your family had experiences with Islamophobia or racism? What was it like? How do you see Muslim Americans treated in your neck of the woods? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Wajahat Ali is a playwright, a columnist for The Daily Beast, co-host of the Democracy-ish podcast, and author of the new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. Wajahat, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You've got no shortage of stories to tell in your life story, from awkward childhood moments to near-death experiences and more. What led you to want to put it all down in memoir-ish form?
Yeah, memoirish. I like that. Go Back to Where You Came From is about loving a country that doesn't always love you back. And I consider it an elegy for the rest of us who oftentimes are seen as the co-protagonists, sidekicks, villains, or we're completely erased from the story and just treated as footnotes. And I thought in this moment in time, there might be an opening, Rob, where fellow Americans might realize, these people of color, these immigrants, these marginalized folks, they're not lying about this thing called white supremacy and racism. They might be onto something. And all their warnings about our democracy being under attack and the fact that we might not have a multiracial democracy, there might be something here to it. So I thought this was a critical time where I could tell this story, my story, but connect it to the story of America right now, undergoing many atrocities and horrors as we are simultaneously doing this push and pull between nativist trends that have existed and the trend to push and expand this country to accommodate all of our children as its potential co-protagonists. So I thought the time was now.
Your parents laid out three career options for you, as I understand it. Doctor, engineer, or successful businessman. Not just businessman, successful businessman. How did you develop your superpower as a writer and storyteller?
Well, yeah, the fourth option is failure. So you forgot failure.
I forgot failure. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
That's what I call the immigrant checklist of success. It's not just South Asian parents, but it's basically, hey, we came to this country. We left behind everything. We didn't leave behind everything for you to become an English major. And, you know, we want stability and security for you. And we want the dreams that you can't have. So you have to be a doctor or an engineer or a dubious businessman or a businesswoman who somehow makes a lot of money and he marries well and has 2.1 kids and gets a nice house and gets either a Toyota Acura or a BMW. And, you know, my parents, being Pakistani immigrant parents, very traditional. We always joke that they brought the boat inside the home. Like, they didn't burn the boat. They brought the boat inside the home. First of all, they named me Wajahat, obviously to blend. They didn't teach me English growing up, because who needs English in the Bay Area, California, right? And they said, you'll learn. But they were very supportive of my artistic talents. So I wrote a story at the age of 10. I mentioned this in the book. And a one-page short story became a 10-page short story. And being the shy, awkward, brown, sweaty kid who wore husky pants, who used to get bullied by his classmates, my teacher said, get up and read this story. And I'm like, please don't make me do it. She goes, get up and do it. And for the first time ever, they were rapt with attention. They didn't mock me. They laughed at all the right parts and they applauded. And that's when I kind of discovered I might have a superhero talent. I might be able to tell a story. And I took that story home to my father, who was drinking chai. He says, beta, which means son, you might have a talent here. You might think about becoming a writer. And my mom ran from the kitchen and said, first become a doctor, which is just insurance, right? My mom was like, just have insurance. But I was very lucky, Rob, that my parents were very untraditional in that they always supported and nurtured the talent. And many children of immigrants don't have that support or that encouragement, and which is why they become doctors and engineers, but secretly very unhappy.
A running theme through the book is, you know, you have a lot of identities, awkward kid, writer, later father. I could go on with that list for a long time. When seen from the outside, especially I think after September 11th, other people, mainly white people, looked at you and saw what?
Osama, Saddam, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, suspect, other, terrorist, potential terrorist, helper of terrorists, potential radical terrorist, who might not be a terrorist. Oh, look, a smiling terrorist. It's very interesting that all of us have complex identities, but oftentimes people are of color are the only ones who are hyphenated or have the asterisks, right? And in 9/11, as I mentioned in the book, for many of us, especially those immigrants, children of immigrants, people of color, who grew up as the model minority stereotype, a stereotype I hope to demolish in the book, you know, we thought we were American, born and raised in this country, right? Yeah, sure, we don't see ourselves on the billboards or on the cover of the magazines, but we are American. We identify. But overnight, after 9/11, all of a sudden we became us and them, you know, a terrorist or a suspect. And overnight from that moment on, me, Wajhat Ali, a Muslim brown kid from California, had to represent and defend 1,400 years of Islamic civilization and 1.8 billion Muslims. And no matter what I did, as Toni Morrison said, that's the exhaustion of racism. It's never enough. You always have to prove your worth, and it's never enough because this nameless judge, jury, and executioner always holds your loyalty, moderation, and patriotism as suspect.
We're talking to Wajhat Ali, author of the new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. You can join in with your questions if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you've experienced some of what Wajhat was just talking about, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. The title, Go Back to Where You Came From, you write right off the bat, this is something you've heard, been emailed, you're active on social media, you've certainly encountered in there. What do you do with that when somebody, especially in person, when somebody says that to you? I don't know what I would do.
Yeah, you know what's so interesting is the title of the book is like a gut punch, right? And the book begins with emails that I receive every day, and I just copy paste the emails. And the first email is, go back to where you came from. I get it almost every day in some aspect, some form. And it's interesting is that for me, I'm so used to it, and people of color are so used to it, but there are many readers in the past month, such as yourself, like, oh my God, this happens to you every day? Wow, how would I respond? And it just shows you how it is for the rest of us who, even though we're born and raised in this country, are told to go back. So it's how you respond. And so how I respond in the book is like Bugs Bunny. You know, Bugs Bunny is chased by Elmer Fudd and Yosemite Sam, but he uses their own traps against them and sometimes kisses them on the cheek. And at the end, he gets the last laugh, the last word, and he gets the carrot. And so I respond by saying, would you like me to go back to the Bay Area? I'd love to if you could subsidize the rent. Or, oh, are we all going back to the womb? Okay, Freud. Or do you want me to go back to pre-partition India? Because my parents, even my mother wasn't born in India. She was born in Pakistan. And that type of response with some humor is a response, but also kind of dismantles the stupidity and the bigotry of that comment, right? Where apparently the rest of us are here as conditional citizens, and our citizenship and our home loan application and our mortgage can be revoked at any second based upon our ethnicity. And the real American, Rob, apparently the one who was from here, is the white American who, by the way, wasn't from here. It actually belonged to the indigenous Americans, the Native Americans. So it's an ugly sentiment that has been told even to white Americans who weren't once considered white. And if you know your history, I'm talking about Italians, the Irish Catholic, Eastern European Jews, and the Germans. We were all told at one point to go back to where we came from.
Right. But I wonder how you think that, if that's going to change over generations. Like, my family goes back to Poland and Ireland, some other places. You wouldn't know that unless I told you, or you did my family, my genealogy or whatever. I just read as white now. You are, you know, second generation, your kids, third generation. Do you worry that because of the skin color difference, that's never going to go away?
Yeah, that's a question I address in the book. You know, that's the test of America. Whether or not America will succeed as a multiracial democracy will be whether or not people like me are considered American or my children are considered American. I'll give you an example. Who's been here since the founding? Black folks. Are they still considered American? Nope, still hyphenated. Latinos? Nope, still hyphenated. Mexicans, indigenous Americans, right? With you and your family, you mentioned Polish and Irish, double whammy, both hated back in the day, but you were able to be absorbed into what I call in the book whiteness. And I'm not talking about white people. With whiteness, it's this paradigm, this structure, this ideology that says those who are considered white or labeled white, which is a social construct, are elevated above all others and are seen as the true inheritors of this country called America, right? Where they have the manifest destiny to come birth this country from savagery and bring forth civilizations. but you are able to be absorbed into whiteness because you look quote unquote white. Again, a social construct, even though you weren't considered white like 100 years ago. Irish were not considered white. But how about the rest of us who don't look quote unquote white, even though we've been here even longer? That's the test, right? That's the test, because black folks, people of color, will never be absorbed into whiteness ever. So will we dismantle this ideology of supremacy and have true equality, or will we double down and fight for it and burn the country down? That's the test for the next 20 years.
We're talking to Wajahat Ali about his new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with writer and author Wajahat Ali about his new memoir, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. Wajahat, you think a lot about the portrayal of Pakistani Americans, Muslim Americans in pop culture. I want to take you to a moment. You were younger. Your first kind of breakthrough as a writer was this play you wrote about a Pakistani American family. You're in talks to maybe bring it to L.A., and an agent says, hey, maybe as the Pakistani-American dad, what do you think of Ted Danson?
Yeah, and I laughed, and there was no other laughter on the other end. And I'm like, wait, you're serious? And he said, yeah, Americans like Ted Danson. And I'm like, who doesn't like Ted Danson? I love Ted Danson. I love Cheers. I also like Becker. I also saw him in Gulliver's Travels, but this is a story about a Pakistani-American family, and the father, Salman, is a middle-aged Pakistani man. He goes, well, think about Ted Danson. And this was, you know, the play, The Domestic Crusaders, I started writing as a senior at UC Berkeley after 9/11 upon the suggestion and recommendation of my teacher, Ishmael Reed, who's a MacArthur Genius winner. And he, as a black man, said, listen, we've been fighting back for 400 years. Art and culture is how we fight back and tell our stories. Your people, I'm looking at the news right now after 9/11, your people are going to get hazed for 10 years. He was wrong. It's been 20 years. But he said, I've never seen an American story, a kitchen drama story, told from a perspective of, you know, like Muslims or Pakistanis. Write a story like that. And so that story, I had to do it myself, Rob, because I was told 20 years ago, the mainstream will never accept an ethnic story. Translation, white people will not accept a story of brown and Muslim folks. Take away all the ethnic stereotypes and take away all the ethnic mirch and the masala and make it easy and palatable. I proved them wrong. We did it ourselves. And I just want to flex for a moment. This play that was rejected and mocked and ridiculed 6 months ago, 20th anniversary of 9/11, it was republished by McSweeney's with a foreword by Hasan Minhaj and a new conversation between me and Ishmael Reed and Carla Blank. And the play is being taught in schools. The play has been performed around the world. The play is being sold. And so sometimes you just have to do it yourself, have faith in your story, and have faith that the mainstream will come along.
Let's bring on a caller now. Stephanie is with us in Milwaukee. Stephanie, hi.
Hi. I had a comment and also a question. I'm really interested in this topic. I'm a psychology graduate student, and I'm really interested in intersectionality and cultural humility and working with clients. And then just from my experience, I think that it's really helpful to talk about these things, but there are some kind of things that make it difficult for people to talk about it. So my question is, how are some like maybe general ways that can be really good to talk about these things with people, but also with children, because I work with a lot of children, to just talk about this like in a more open way so that we can talk about our different backgrounds, but also talk about difficult kind of topics and how we can talk in a more like inclusive way, including everyone in this conversations that are very important. Thank you.
Stephanie, thanks. A couple big questions there, Wajahat.
Yeah, look, I have three kids. My kids are age 7, 5, and 2, and my wife and I have this conversation all the time, is because you simultaneously want to infuse in them the sense of pride in their culture and their skin color and their tone, especially which is under assault right now in America and their religion. But at the same time, you don't want them to be chauvinists also, right? Or restrictive or reactionary. And we live in a diverse community in Virginia. And so their classmates are different skin tones and different ethnicities and national origins. So what we say is, listen, this is who we are. You know, you're Pakistani American. This is your name. You're Muslim. But listen, at the same time, we live in a country where there's different people, there's different setups, there's different families. And as such, be respectful to everyone. And so what we do is we have had faith in them and their intelligence. So we talk to them. We talk to them at their level. We explain it to them. They're very curious. They understand. I'll give you an example. Even during the pandemic, we explained to them, this is why we're doing lockdown. This is why we're doing virtual school. There is a pandemic. This is COVID. This is why we wear masks. This is why we wash our hands. My children, ages 7, 5, and 2, Rob, wear masks, social distance, right? Clean their hands and understand the reason why they're doing it is to protect themselves and other folks. So even when it comes to topics about racism and culture and diversity and colorism, which we have to deal with if you're brown and black, because light skin tone is still the preferred skin tone. And my poor 5-year-old daughter, a couple of months ago, I wrote a New York Times article about this. She looked in the mirror and she said, "Oh, I wish I was light skin tone. That's beautiful." And I was like, "No, everything we've done for 5 years is failure." And so we just doubled down and instead, you know, reaffirmed her beauty, her brownness, her brown skin tone, and said there's different colors there. But, you know, you are brown and you're beautiful, just like someone who's white or black is beautiful, but this is who you are. So when you're a brown and black person in this country, you are forced to have these uncomfortable conversations about racism, right, and colorism. And I'll just say that really quickly because oftentimes we're having this conversation, and, oh, my God, our children, they can't tolerate these conversations. We have to protect them. I'm like, I was confronted with this at the age of 5 when I was dropped off at preschool and someone said, your skin color is the color of poo. Kids are dealing with this stuff, and it's up to us as parents to actually engage them and give them the right language and the right type of empathy and kindness, and also have faith in them that, listen, you know, this is the world we live in, and these are some of the values that we have, and you can be proud of who you are, but you also have to live in a community of diversity and understand that other folks have different lifestyles as well. And so that's how we've tried to model it. We just go straight in. We talk to them, we treat them with intelligence and sensitivity, and they get it. The kids get it.
Thanks for that call, Stephanie. We're talking to Wajahat Ali. His new book is Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on Becoming American. Wajahat, I hope you don't mind if I spoil the ending a little bit. You come out with a full endorsement of the power of hope. And as a dad, the story you tell to back that up really hit me. Can you share the story of your daughter and how people came together to give you this hope?
Yeah, the last chapter of the book is called Invest in Hope, but Tie Your Camel First, which is based on this beautiful saying in Islam, have faith in God, but tie your camel first, which means do everything within your power to fix your situation. And after you've done that, you know, there's nothing else you can do except have faith. And, you know, having hope is very dangerous oftentimes in hopeless times because it means exposing yourself to the possibility that when the page turns, it brings a better story. But oftentimes we're met with what? Pain, disappointment, betrayal, regret. And so it's easier to curl up and have your shields go up and be defensive and cynical and apathetic, right? But like I said in the book, that often requires zero investment and means being a spectator. You know, being in the ring of life means exposing yourself to pain. And that was really brought to the forefront with my daughter's diagnosis 3 years ago, where she was diagnosed 8 months before the pandemic with stage 4 liver cancer, all over the liver with a cancer speck in her lungs. And we're like, we didn't know she'd survive. And we needed a full liver transplant and time was running out. And with the power of storytelling, I shared Nuseiba's story, and over 500 people, mostly strangers, stepped up to potentially be a liver donor for a girl they had never met, including people who told me they hated my politics, but they wanted to save a little girl. And finally, this one anonymous donor who later revealed himself to be Sean Zaheer, who coincidentally lived close by, decided, oh, let me go give a piece of my liver to this little girl. And this little girl survived because a community came together to rally around a little girl who had stage 4 cancer. You know, we raised the funds, raised the word, got an anonymous donor, Sean Zaheer, and now Nuseiba is in the next room, dressed up in one of her many costume changes of the day, Rob, you know, cancer-free, healthy, living her best life. And, you know, she's still immunosuppressed during a pandemic. But, you know, throughout that journey, I imagined what would happen if she passed away, if she prepared myself as a parent, right? Mm-hmm. So I imagined it and I steeled myself with these possibilities. But there was also another narrative where she lived and she lived to be happy and healthy and married and have kids. And I chose to invest in that story.
Do I remember this right? Sean Zaheer, the person who had donated a chunk of liver to your daughter, his question on waking up is, Doc, when can I donate blood next time?
Yeah. Just that was his first question. And the doctor who operated on him, he started crying. He said, listen, I've done this a lot of times. That's the first time I've ever had a donor wake up and ask that question. Usually it's like, when can I get back to work? Am I safe? Am I healthy? But he said, hey, when can I give blood again? Because he's also a marrow and blood donor. And then he told me, he says, you have a good man's liver in your daughter. You have a good man's liver in your daughter. You're very lucky.
And just our last minute, Wajahat, how can we follow his example? I don't know, how can we pick that path of hope and generosity over all the other stuff we know is out there?
In the final minute, I will say this. I often get told, I'm nobody, Waj. And I'm like, some of my favorite people are nobody. I'm a nobody also. I think everyone has a superhero talent. Everyone has something. And the way you behave, the way you model yourself every day in your life, at home, at school, at work, can be a reflection of how you want this country to be. Run for school board, run for city council, you know, go out to a church, do interfaith, give money to the right candidates. In your behavior, in your language, change it up to be more empathetic, more sensitive, and try to model this behavior for your children. Think about how that will impact future generations. At the end of the day, we could only control our own actions and our own intentions. And if we model that behavior, then you know what? That's the best way to go out.
Wajahat, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob, for having me.
Wajahat Ali is a columnist for the Daily Beast. He's a playwright. He was with us sharing his new book. It's called Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on Becoming American.